In the following recording, Judy Getty and Lauren Getty King and Kathy Schweitzall from the Palmer Public Library discuss the book Shadow of the Wind by Carlos Ruiz Zafón. Originally recorded on Wednesday, October 29th at noon, we rebroadcast it for your listening pleasure. Enjoy.
We were talking about The Shadow of the Wind on Radio Book Club for October's Friends of Library Week.
And so Friends comes in to save the day and provide many means of getting the support and programming that we need to be able to do what we do and provide resources for the community.
So if somebody wanted to join that group, how would they do that?
I think the first step would be just to contact the library. Friends operates out of the library, and so you'd be welcome to call the library anytime at 745-4690. And Friends also holds regular meetings once a month. They are the third Monday of the month at 7 p.m. They are open to the public, and they would encourage you to come in and share what you'd like to see happen and invite you to get involved.
Okay, thanks. And Lauren, I asked you to read the book as you are studying Spanish. This book is a translation. I'm also hoping that you'll have some comments to add to the conversation about what was happening politically in Spain. And also, I'm hoping you'll correct me at least when I pronounce the names incorrectly, because, of course, I do not bring the correct sound to these words.
Well, and I can't do the French ones, so someone else is going to have to come help us out with that, I guess. But, well, I don't want to go too far in depth into the history, but the book has a really nice way of incorporating what was going on at the time historically into the plot. So basically, the Spanish Civil War began in 1936, and the book starts shortly after the end of the Civil War in 1939. And in 1936, there was an attempted military coup to take control of the newly founded Republic of Spain. And the rebels were called the Nationalists. They were mostly the Catholics, military members, businessmen, landowners, and the most powerful group among them was the Falange, or the fascist movement, led by Francisco Franco, who is also mentioned in the book. They mention him a few times, not in any very nice way. On the other side, we had the Republicans, who were primarily agricultural workers, urban workers, members of the middle class. So you had a really strong division politically and socially, I mean, between classes and pretty much in all facets of society. So that really shines through in the book.
Okay.
I'm sure we'll talk about that more, yeah.
Well, and especially the character Fumero, because he switches political sides.
Yes, like, changes loyalties.
Yeah, like the weather. So that'll come up more when we talk about that. I also just wanted to say this is actually a little bit of an older book. It was published in 2001 in Spain, and it's Zafón's first novel for adults. And it's the first of his books to be translated into English, which didn't come out in the United States until April of 2004. So I have talked to some people who have read it and really, really liked this book. I also want to remind our readers that, or our listeners, I should say, that they can call in. If you're listening to this broadcast at noon to 1 on October 29th, then that is the live broadcast, and you can call in and share your thoughts with us. The number is 745-8900. So let's just start out with a general question. Especially from a librarian's point of view, if you had to shelf this book, what genre would you use to describe the book?
I think if I were cataloging the book myself, I would have started with mystery. There's a lot of mystery in the book and a lot of secrets to unveil. However, I was surprised when turning our copy around that ours is in general fiction. So I would, according to our library, have been wrong, but I would have gone with mystery.
And it, as a book that we ended up reading in October, and I know I picked because it was Friends of Library, but it really was a good October book in mm-hmm. the terms of it, you know, was mysterious and suspenseful and a little bit spooky sometimes.
Yeah, and it was really kind of amazing how he managed to put in sort of this almost a film noir aspect of it. Like, you could see people walking around in the rain wearing trench coats, and there were shadows everywhere, and you really got a feel for that.
I as I was reading the story, I actually did picture it usually in black and white.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. So it does have that kind of film noir look to it. And there was some stuff online about making this into a movie. And it has not been. There was one little cheesy thing that Lauren and I looked at on YouTube that I don't even know what that was about, but it did not look good considering what a great story this is. But it would make a great movie just mm-hmm. visually looking at some of this stuff. It's also a little bit of a love story. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as we talk about some of the characters, we can see how those romantic parts unfold. I also think that there was parts of it that were magical realism. And so I know, Katie, you were saying something about you looked at how that's defined, and there's some kind of controversy.
I did. I went online after reading to scour and think just to discover what other people thought. And that was a hot topic, was the magical realism and tearing apart. There really isn't any magic. It's just kind of intrigue and imagination at play, or how the characters seemed a little dismissive, that they didn't think there was any magic going on, that they seemed to just kind of breeze past that part. And so I thought it was interesting to hear other people's takes on the magical realism aspect of the book itself and kind of the controversy it raised. Mm-hmm.
I thought it really came into play when they were describing the old the Aldaya mansion, the old house. So, you know, the spirits that lived there, or even just the noises, which I'm not entirely sure if that fits into magical realism, because a lot of, and then, you know, additionally, just like dreaming of angels and dark souls and stuff was quite interesting.
Well, since you brought up the Aldaya Mansion, so it was supposedly cursed angel of the mist. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it seems to be a character in its own right, and it has a life of its own, creaking, moaning, and breathing fire in its belly. So, you know, I guess when you were talking about magical realism, my sense of it is, and again, you know, I could be wrong about how they define that, but that, so in this culture, that's just accepted. So they're not going, oh, this is some kind of bizarre black thing, mm-hmm. you know, black magic happening, or, you know, supernatural thing happening. It is just accepted as part of life, that these spirits and these things surround us, and they are just a natural part of the world. And so I never get the sense that they're thinking, you know, oh, that's magic, or that shouldn't be there. But the Aldaya Mansion certainly has some kind of spooky or magical aspects to it.
Right.
And different characters come in and out of it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, different things are happening there. And then certainly bad things have happened there. And eventually we learn that there's bodies buried in the basement.
Right.
So that can certainly lead to the sense that that's a mm-hmm. spooky place.
And the way that it ran its course, I mean, living, well, the Aldaya Mansion almost as its own character played a parallel role, or a role in the parallel lives of Carax and Daniel, which was interesting that it affected them kind of in the same way, and the same things sort of happened to them in that very house, which makes it all the more magical.
So there's two stories kind of happening simultaneously in this book, Daniel's story and Julian Carax's story. And as it turns out, Daniel obtains a copy of the book that Julian had written several years earlier, decades earlier, called The Shadow of the Wind. And so as it's unfolded, and this is a quote, as it had unfolded, the structure of the story began to remind me of one of those Russian dolls that contain innumerable, ever smaller dolls within. Zafon's The Shadow of the Wind unfolds much the same way, with many characters contributing fragments of their own stories in the first-person point of view. So this is kind of a different way of storytelling, and then we get all these mini autobiographies along the way. So how does that contribute, do you think, to the story or the storytelling of this tale?
I enjoyed the mini autobiographies and the different perspectives. I think, life is that way. And so I just appreciated reading it. I think it's interesting to hear different people's perspectives and how their attitudes could change perceptions or the part of the story they're telling. And I think it really worked in the book, and I appreciated reading various accounts.
I agree. I think in a lot of fiction, especially from a first-person point of view, you get you can get other characters' stories and everything, but it's through the eyes of one person. And I think that it was very valuable to have information coming from all different directions, and then have the ability to hear the main character's perspective on it afterwards made it particularly dynamic.
And I think it lends to the mystery aspect of this book because we're only getting that piece of the story. And so as we get those different pieces and you're trying to put this together, do you do that when you read a mystery? That, okay, I've got that little piece and this little piece.
Make notes. I have triangles written between people and arrows in the back of my book. Yeah, it was confusing.
It could be confusing, yes. In fact, when I was making a list of who the characters are, it was like, who are all the many people that come in and out of this story? Yeah. So, Katie, do you do that, try to solve the mystery?
I do. I feel like I love it. And I can't help myself whether it's in video or book, but trying to guess what is it, what happened, what is the mystery. And then, yeah, I love getting the little puzzle pieces and thinking I'm right until the end.
So I guess simply put, the mystery is that Daniel, how do you say his name?
Daniel works.
We'll just say Daniel.
English.
Okay, thank you. So Daniel gets this book when his father takes him to the Cemetery of Forgotten Books, which, okay, you just got to love that too. Mm-hmm. So just, you know, think about that for a minute. Why would they have a place called the Cemetery of Forgotten Books?
Oh, I wanted to go there. I loved it. I thought that was one of the best ideas of the whole book was a cemetery and the idea of it. I thought was really thrilling and exciting, and I loved it. And so in response to your question of why they had it, there's dead or dying books or maybe books people don't want you to read. And I think it's really, really cool that the community of people were recognizing and noticing that some of their favorite or beloved titles were just not able to be found anymore, so they found a new place for them. And I thought it was so cool. There's kind of a secret society built around protecting books.
Do you think that is any kind of political statement for Spain, Lauren? With what was happening? I mean, were they doing banned books, do you know, in the Spanish Civil War?
I don't actually know. I imagine there was some level of censorship going on with that type of control. I mean, a military dictatorship. But in terms of culturally, I mean, with entertainment and such, I'm not entirely sure.
Okay. And I like what you said too, Katie, because sometimes I think of when I go into a library and they've got books that are like discard books and you think, they've lost a home, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. What's going to happen to them?
I loved how the book described it. There's a whole universe inside of a book. So to have a building dedicated to forgotten universes, like what a tragedy, all of the treasures that are in there and the stories and adventures to be had. So I fell in love with that idea. I wish we could have spent a little more time in the Cemetery of Books.
And he has other books in the series, so I don't know if the Cemetery of Forgotten Books comes up in those other books. But one of the early quotes, I mean, at the very beginning, and Daniel is speaking, he says, "I was raised among books," because his father owns a bookstore, "making invisible friends in pages that seemed cast from dust and whose smell I carry on my hands to this day." So, you know, this whole idea that when we read a book and a book that means something to us, we carry that within us.
It's true. I can relate to that. I think it's true whether you're inspired or scared or whatever sort of emotion you might get from certain stories. They do stay with you, and I thought it was really well put in the quote that you just read as well.
So, as I was saying, Daniel goes into the Cemetery of Forgotten Books, and the book he picks is The Shadow of the Wind by Julian Carax. And then the mystery is, what happened to all of Julian's books? And so that's what he's trying to solve without really knowing kind of what a Pandora's box he's opening up. Mm-hmm. So the other thing is the setting of this book. And we talked a little bit about how it's portrayed as dark. And it's kind of interesting, the back of the book too, you get kind of a guided walking tour. And so that, again, it's like you could go there and walk in the footsteps of these characters. But do you think that set in this place for a particular reason, the Gothic quarter of Barcelona?
I think it just sort of adds to that feeling, that noir. Just sort of the mystery around it. And then with how much importance they place on the city, I mean, not, you know, all the time, but I think it's Vermeer says something about, you know, just look around. This is such a great city. I mean, they comment on it. And it's very cool how they can get around using really any method of transportation. They take the bus. He's running all over the city. I think it adds to sort of the perspective you're not only getting from people, but all the different parts of the city and how how everything can be different in so many different places.
Okay, you're listening to Radio Book Club. We're talking about The Shadow of the Wind. And if you have some comments or want to share your thoughts, call us at 745-8900. So let's talk about, I guess, some of the evil characters in the book. So certainly some of the devil-type figures are Crax's Lane Colbert. Mm-hmm. So do you want to talk about how, you know, he kind of plays two roles in the book?
Yeah, my first amusing observation was the devil who's burning books. So I did appreciate the symbolism there. I'm sorry, and I lost where I was going with that. So if you have anything to add on, please.
But no, I was glad you said that, the first amusing, because there's many funny parts in this mm-hmm. book, too.
Yes, yeah, but, yeah, there's a lot of humor.
We would, Lauren and I, as we were reading it, we would note sometimes that that was such a kind of a, you know, a subtle, very downplayed kind of funny way of saying something. But did you want to say something about Lane Colbert?
Besides the fact that I didn't know how to say his name for a good portion of the book, so I considered him the devil as well because he was really turning against me in my only Spanish-speaking knowledge. So, but other than that, I actually oftentimes mixed him and Fumero up while I was reading.
Okay.
So, which is kind of funny when you think about where their stories end up. But, yeah, I don't.
So Lane Colbert is a character in the Julian book. And then later on, Daniel meets somebody who says he's Lane Colbert. Mm-hmm. And so it's Lane Colbert, this characterization of him that's looking for all of Julian's books and is trying to destroy them all. So like we said, that as Daniel's unwrapping this mystery, this is certainly a part of it, is why are these books all being destroyed? Another one of the devil figures is Jacinta. Is that right? Jacinta?
Jacinta, yeah.
Jacinta is the governess or nurse of Julian's love, Penelope. And she has this angel or dark angel that appears to her, Zacharias. And when we were talking about the magical realism, that's probably, you know, part of that too. So what, you know, what was the necessity of having that, do you think?
That was one of those mysterious figures that I could not figure out.
But he gives her guidance in some ways.
And yeah.
Okay, because early in her life, she's married and she's not having a family, so her husband dumps her. And Zacharias tells her that she'll have a child.
Mm-hmm.
And so later on when she, you know, gets work in the Aldaya home and now is the caretaker for Penelope, it's sort of like what this devil figure told her has come true.
But it was sort of a bad omen, too, because she lost it and everything that she ever loved along with Penelope. So, yeah, you couldn't really figure out if he was good or evil. And then the imagery was so intense with his long nails and his teeth. I mean, it was really quite gruesome to me.
Very Halloween figure
yes.
again, right? Okay, and probably the most evil or devil figure of all is Fumero.
I loved that character.
You did?
I did. I mean, like, you know, he was a bad guy. I hated him, you know, for all intents and purposes. But I thought analyzing him and once you got to know more about his childhood and stuff was you had a little more to go on for, you know, his motivations and his actions. So
one layer of the story is, as it's unwrapped, is you find out that many of these characters grew up together. They were mm-hmm. children together. So in the Julian part of the story, that track of it. And so Julian and Fumero went to school together. They mm-hmm. were schoolmates. And yes, so you were saying, you know, part of his childhood that explains mm-hmm. it. So Fumero has some really humiliating kinds of experiences. They're at a very impressive boarding school. But Julian is there as kind of a ward of someone else, and Fumero is there because his father is a caretaker on mm-hmm. the property. And so they're obviously a lower class. But Fumero wears that very badly. And so he has some experiences then there that really impact how he sees the world. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you want to talk about that one incident, the party. With his mother.
Yes, well, so Fumero, as a child, goes to the Aldaya mansion for, I believe it was Jorge's birthday. And all of the other friends are there, including Julian, who has been able to overcome his sort of social status at the boarding school and become friends, better friends with the people Javier Fumero is supposed to be friends with. And Javier is also crushing on Penelope, who's got a thing going with Julian. So when he sees that, that's sort of doubly heartbreaking for him that he's losing all these people. Most memorably probably of the scene is that his mother has put him in a little blue sailor suit in an attempt to dress him up for the high socialites of the party.
And so did you get an image of that? Just poor kid, and he must look ridiculous.
Miserable, humiliated. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yep.
Well, and then as Fermin and Daniel are learning more about the story, Fermin, of course, gets to throw it in Fumero's face later as an adult. So
yes,
can really tug on some bad stuff there.
So that impacts him in the sense that I think even then that he already has this sense of he wants to destroy Julian. Mm-hmm. And then just talk a little bit more, either one of you, about, you know, Fumero's trajectory then through the book. What kind of, you know, experiences does he have and what kind of person he becomes?
He just seemed purely evil to me. I thought his role was necessary. It contrasted the more angelic depictions of other characters. And so I thought for kind of the sake of contrast, it was definitely necessary and worked for the story. But yeah, it could be a little shocking to kind of read it, the relentless evil he seemed to just relish in almost.
And I guess I thought it was more acquired because of his trauma as a child. He just sort of adopted it as his main mission to get rid of Julian, whose person he could blame all of his problems on, as this, like, external locus in his life. So it gave him meaning in life somehow. He went through, he went through his whole life just seeking out to end Julian's career and ultimately life.
And he does have a quest for power.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you were talking before about what was happening politically in Spain, everything that led up to the Spanish Civil War, certainly Fumero was a part of that. And we get a little of his history that he would, you know, kind of always try to pick the winning side and be, strive to be a leader or somebody with power on that side. So he becomes a very sadistic, torturous kind of individual. He works for the police. Are they secret police or it's just the police force?
Well, he's called inspector. I think it's the police.
Okay, so so he's got this position of authority and he abuses it. The character Fermin is one of his victims, I guess we could say. But there are many people that would be tortured and questioned by Fermin and his cronies.
Yeah, so. And perhaps it's too bold a statement to say he was sort of similar to kind of a Franco, you know, at the time, because with just power seeking and sort of in control over people who simply didn't have the status.
I would agree. I think he had fickle allegiances based on where power was coming from. I think that would be really fair to say.
So it's always interesting with a male author to look at how they draw the female characters. And the female characters in this book have been described as enigmatic, otherworldly, angels full of power and mystery. So Clara is the daughter of individual Barcelo, who wishes to buy The Shadow of the Wind, the copy of the book that Daniel has, because it's an extremely rare book, because Lane Colbert has supposedly gone all over the world and destroyed copies of all of these books. And so it's so rare that Barcelo wants to get this copy that he's heard Daniel has. And so by his contact with Daniel, now Daniel meets Clara, his blind daughter. So what did you think of Clara?
I had a hard time with her because from the get-go, I just felt like she was toying with Daniel. And so he loved her. He loved her. And that's what I found a little interesting in drawing comparisons between the three, Clara, Bea, and Daniel's mother. It was definitely this kind of a pedestal they were on, but they also seemed to torment Daniel in a way. And it just made me feel for him. He kind of threw his heart out there, and it was hurt. And so...
Well, there is a big age difference when they meet.
He's
12, 11, 12, mm-hmm. and she's 18,
in her early 20s or something.
21, maybe. Yeah. So, yeah, it's huge. So for her, it was probably like, oh, this little boy has a crush on me.
Like he's a cutie or something. Yeah.
And he'd come over and read to her because she was blind. So he would use that as an excuse to spend time with her.
Yeah. So,
but you're right. I mean, it was, from her point of view, maybe complimentary, but without thinking exactly how building that relationship was going to affect him in the long run.
Yeah.
So she becomes a fallen angel in some respects. So, Lauren, do you want to comment on what happens as far as...
As far as what?
Well, Daniel goes over to the house, and what does he... He discovers that.
Yeah, she's doing the deed with Nuri, her piano teacher, who's older, and so I'm sure Daniel felt very out of his league even more. But once he witnesses that, I think he kind of realizes that that's really when he discovers he doesn't have a chance. And so his heart is broken, and he runs out sort of vowing never to return.
And Nuri beats him up, too. So
yes, he gets throws him out. That's true.
Yeah. A broken heart and
a broken nose.
Yeah. And a broken nose, yeah. And you're right. And so then later on, when Daniel and Clara kind of have contact again, it's very different for him. And although he claims, you'll always be my friend, you've always been my friend, it's no longer, I think, that romanticized vision of her. So another woman in the book is Bea. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So Bea is Daniel's love interest. And she is the sister of his best friend, Tomas. And I want to talk a little bit about the character Bea and what... And I guess we should introduce Penelope, too, because those are really kind of the parallel characters. Mm-hmm. So Penelope, I think we said that she is Julian's love interest, and she's the sister of one of Julian's schoolmates. So there's kind of that similarity there, too. So Bea and Daniel have this love.
Yeah, and that was another, the parallels between, I guess, maybe more a product of the time of dating outside your social class and what your neighbors might think. And so I found that interesting between the two of how it was kind of tried to squashed or kept secret the feelings between the two and crossing social classes. In dating, and so that was interesting to read between Penelope and Bea as well, with the similarities.
I think also personality speaking, Bea was a strong female character, and up until he sort of had feelings for her, Daniel always said he was scared of her. Very scared of her.
And how he meets her, or one of the first introductions we have to Bea is he says something to Tomas about, your sister is stuck up or something?
Yeah,
is that
something.
What he says? Something,
yeah.
And so, yes, he spends years fearing her, really. Mm-hmm. And we should also mention Bea has a fiancé, so she's supposed to marry a soldier.
Yes. And it felt kind of random or abrupt to me when he went to see Bea at the college and just, you know, he still fears her, but then, whoa, all of a sudden it's like, all right, Bea. So that felt, I don't know, felt abrupt to me.
Okay.
But
there's a lot of love at first sight sort of stuff going on that I didn't really
more
know
magic.
What to make.
Yeah,
possibly. I didn't really know what to make of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, you're right, because Julian, the same thing, when he sees Penelope come down the staircase at the Eldaya Mansion.
Yeah.
And she's 13 at the time. You know, he falls in love with her immediately.
And it's worth, look at all the trouble he went to, for seeing her that one time and falling in love instantly.
So as we're talking about this, Fermin falls in love immediately with what's the...
Bernarda. Yeah.
And that's Barceló's... Mm-hmm. I have to hesitate on
Barceló's.
Barceló's housekeeper or something. Yeah. So Yeah, so you're right. That really is kind of a thing here in this book, too.
And yeah, and they develop quite quickly.
I don't know, is it? I wasn't sure if it was a Spanish culture thing or just specific to the book, but there's a lot of quick love sorts of things mm-hmm. going on.
Again, part of that romanticized culture, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So Daniel and Bea do, develop this relationship. And do you think that she plays a part in saving his life? That's a big leap to kind of to the end of the book.
But yeah.
I
don't actually remember what she does, because Daniel gets shot at the end of the book during the scuffle. And then Bea shows up and kind of holds his hand. I guess I didn't remember that she saved him in any sort of way. But I mean, besides, being there for him.
So do you remember that foreshadowing that's done where Daniel says, I'll be dead in 7 days?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so that, again, is one of the things that this author does is because, and it's like, what?
Yeah.
We're going to lose this character. And so we have to, now it's like, oh, what's going to be happening in these 7 days? So it's a little bit misleading because, of course, he's shot and he probably flatlines and so he does die. But I think, what you said there, Lauren, is probably that piece of it that, Bea tethers him then to this world mm-hmm. by holding on to him.
Yes, because he saw his mom. So he was tempted to go to the other side, I think. But he, ultimately stayed with his love, Bea.
So. Mm-hmm. And so you brought up Daniel's mom. So she, they say, is actually an angel.
Mm-hmm.
And Daniel lost her when he was very young. And so he talks about at one point where he says, I can't remember what my mother looked like anymore. So.
Mm-hmm. And he refuses to look at the picture because he doesn't want that to be the memory of his mom, as her face in a picture. He wants to remember her naturally. So.
Which is kind of a curious thing. Mm-hmm. I think we all use pictures to prompt memories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I thought it was heartbreaking, though. It broke my heart that he couldn't remember his mom's face, and he was just so upset about it.
Mm-hmm. I think we got carried away with talking, and I need to say that it's the bottom of the hour plus 3 minutes. And listeners, this is 89.5 Radio Free Palmer. You're listening to Radio Book Club, and we're talking about The Shadow of the Wind by Carlos Ruiz Zafón. So if you want to join in and if you've read the book or if you just think that the book sounds fascinating, give us a call at 745-8900. So, because we have this kind of, good and bad or, good and evil characters, do you think that, do you think he did that intentionally, that the women are like the good characters for the most part and the men are the dark or evil characters?
I can't help but to think it'd be intentional, but I'm not sure why exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it would be very intentional, and I'm not sure what the author's trying to say about that. I would be really interested if it'd be more of a reflection of him personally or if that's just how he chose to tell a story and it's accessible and understandable, and so he used kind of a straight split between the two. I'm not sure, but it was I found it interesting nonetheless.
Well, and would you say that the male characters that we would classify as good are purely good, or would you think that they have aspects of them that are, dark or evil? Thinking of, Julian.
I suppose, well, yeah, I think so. I think he's sort of troubled, and that plays into his actions, which were, of course, dark. He is actually Lane Colbert. So he, he's destroying himself while destroying everything he's built and ultimately impacting other people's lives as well. So I think he's got some issues for sure.
I think it'd be fair to say there's flaws, amongst them. And I think it enhances their characters. You kind of want to root for them, but I think those flaws, too, it makes it a little more accessible and empathetic to follow their stories and to kind of root for them.
But that's more realistic, I suppose. There's a fight of good and evil in everyone,
mm-hmm.
So to speak. And even Fermin, who I think is just has a great heart, but he's got this kind of shady past, and you don't learn about it until later on in the book. But you wonder, is he a good guy? You kind of wonder. So,
And I was going to bring him up as we were talking about that, the dark and the light side within a person. And I think he's, again, a wonderful example of that. So he's a victim of Fumero's torture. Mm-hmm. And so we don't really know why, you know, if he was just on the wrong political side at the time. Or, of course, he says that he was, I think, a spy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so he was very likely on the wrong political side. And then as we're introduced to him, and he's the one who's oftentimes kind of funny.
Mm-hmm.
But he plays such a pivotal role in this because he really takes on Daniel's quest.
Mm-hmm.
And he wants to help and get as much information as possible also. And so he, I think as a reader, I was really curious as to what was going to happen to him. And you know, once I accepted that, he was a good guy. But even... And I think the author was really good at doing this. At one point when Fumero is confronting Daniel about your friend Fairman, and he says, what name is he using now? And so there's a little seed of doubt that's planted. And so you're not really sure, well, you know, who is he? Maybe he's, you know, not really helping Daniel. So I think the author did a good job at, you know, constantly kind of keeping you on your toes about that.
Mm-hmm. And if anything else, I appreciated Fermin's character for kind of the witty relief as well.
Mm-hmm.
This book, I think, without him could have been just kind of dark and maybe not so feel good. And so I appreciated his character for the wit and humor he brought, and I enjoyed him for that.
Totally. I wrote down that he functioned as the comic relief, but I also thought he represented the sort of revolutionary character at the time. More than any of the other characters, comments on what's happening socially. And he really bashes it. And I think it would even have been dangerous to say so at the time, because Franco ruled until 1975. So, you know, Fermin's saying all of this stuff about the church. He plays a role, and he's a godly man when he needs to be, when he needs some answers. But he bashes the church, the government, obviously the police.
Well, it sounds like we might have a caller. Hello, this is Radio Free Palmer. And we have, and I think we're not picking you up on air, Melissa, so I'm just going to relay that you talked about how much you really love this book, and that, you know, when you said that about atmospheric, and part of what we've been talking about is how Barcelona is such a great place for this story to occur, and it's so gothic, and the sense of it's almost like a film noir if you imagine it, and what these characters are doing as they move through the city. Thank you, Melissa, for joining us. Bye. So, Melissa talked about how she read this book quite a while ago, so she couldn't remember all the details, but just that, you know, it's one of those books, I think, that as time goes by, you just remember that you relish it. So I think that speaks to, you know, I'll give it 5 stars. So we were talking about Fairman, but I think we need to introduce another really important character, Nuria. And Nuria bridges both stories. And she was also friends with many of the main characters. And how did she initially come to know Julian? Do one of you remember?
Publishing house?
Okay, mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. So she worked at the publishing house that published Julian's books. And so she falls in love with him when she goes to visit him in Paris. And they start an affair there. So she maintains contact with him, but recognizes at the same time that he will always love Penelope, and so she will never be the first person in his heart. And So she has a very pivotal role. She tells a lengthy autobiography later on in the book. One of the things that's quoted on our list of things that we are talking about is she says to Daniel, Julian once wrote that coincidences are the scars of fate. There are no coincidences, Daniel. We are the puppets of our unconscious. So, you know, right at the very beginning of the book, when Daniel goes into the cemetery of forgotten books and he picks up The Shadow of the Wind, and the author says, I felt sure that The Shadow of the Wind had been waiting for me there for years, probably since before I was born. So this really is, you know, setting the scene then, I guess, that this is about fate. And so it's not coincidences. And we might think that it's coincidences because as all these parts come together, you know, they're investigating it and they're pursuing who all these people are that are a part of this story. But, you know, what Nuria is saying is that these are the scars of fate.
Nuria is such a philosopher, and I don't know what to read into some of the things she says. But obviously that something led Daniel to her and their story, I think.
I agree. I had a hard time kind of sorting out my personal impression from what Nuria was saying, mostly because I agree 100% that that life has a way and a reason for doing things, and we don't always know what they are. And I felt that applied to this as well, that that Daniel was meant to find that book and meant to discover their story. And I don't disagree with her, so it's kind of hard to separate my personal from the book's points, but I agree with her.
Mm-hmm. I guess I was thinking in the book there are larger powers at play. They touch on religion, and then we talked about the spirituality or the magic that was happening. And I think books almost go into this other sort of category, like they can lead you another place, and they're a power in themselves. And so in this way, Daniel has, this lays out his path for life. He ultimately marries Bea, who he, you know, may not have otherwise gone on this adventure with. And so it's interesting how, yeah, it sort of leads people to their fate or their destiny, if you will.
So you're, touching on a couple of things that we can take that conversation in. And one of them is that the observation that Julian and Daniel's lives follow very similar trajectories. And I guess we would say Julian's ends in tragedy, but Daniel's ends in happiness. So, you know, we talked about one similarity is they you know, see these girls very early on in their lives and immediately fall in love with them. And for Daniel, that ultimately ends in the marriage and having a child with Bea. But for Julian, it's unrequited love. Well, it's not unrequited love. It's, how would you describe it? It's interfered with love for a very good reason.
Yes.
And you know, we can divulge that, I suppose. But then, because of that, it just ruins him. He can never, even though it was very youthful love, he never gets over it. He never can really love again, even though Nuria would be more than happy to to be his soulmate or his lifelong love. So what other kinds of differences do you see in these two male characters and their kind of the life that they go through?
I don't know. I was really struggling with some of the points you brought up about with such similar circumstances, why one outcome would be for Daniel and why Julian's would be different. And I don't know what to say. I think the question goes outside of the book, too, where you have similar experiences and why it plays out well for someone and not someone else. And so I don't know the answer to that. But nonetheless, it was really great to read through and read the similarities. But I'm glad Daniel's had a happy ending. At least I was rooting for him.
So Penelope and Bea both end up pregnant. And so one difference is that Penelope's father, Julian escapes. He thinks he's going off somewhere and that Penelope's going to join him. And so he leaves for Paris. But she is really, like, kept as a prisoner in her home. I mean, truly locked in a room and has the baby and ends up dying and the baby dies. So, that's certainly very tragic. And Bea, who Daniel has impregnated, is also being kept away from him by her father, but she manages to escape.
See, and I remember, I mean, that is true, but I remember it as Daniel decided to act because he went over to the house and then found out she was missing and you know, mm-hmm. found her. And I thought that was sort of a key difference between Carax, who, I mean, he was waiting for Penelope. It was sort of a more passive route to take. He went and waited in Paris thinking she would, show up eventually. But Daniel, and even like earlier in the book, when Fermin was being physically abused by Fumero, Daniel's thinking, I didn't do anything. I should have done something. I need to be more active. I need to do more things. So I think he decided to go after Bea, and that's a really big personality difference between Carax and Daniel.
I think that's true, whether you want to be the victim or not, mm-hmm. and then acting. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's a really good observation, because when Daniel decides to go and tell Bea's father, okay, I'm the man you're looking for, mm-hmm. I'm the one who Bea's been sneaking off and seeing me, that takes a lot of courage.
And especially with how many times this kid's gotten beat up.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the situations he's been in, yes. And so Julian is more passive, and maybe he's taking his action, I guess, by writing books. Mm-hmm. Because afterwards, when Nuria, I think, is the one who observes that his stories all have settings that are like the Aldaya Mansion and people that have been in Julian's life that are peopled in his stories. So that's where. And okay, so let's divulge why. I mean, for the story to really be okay, I think, with readers, what happens to Penelope almost has to happen. So Julian never discovers this, so we can talk about that too. But what everyone who's in Julian's life is protecting him from is that Penelope is his half sister. That it turns out that Daniel's mother and Penelope's father had,
well, Julian's mother.
Julian, thank you. Julian's mother, I know all these characters, had this affair. And I wouldn't even say, Julian's mother's name was Sophie. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't even say that it was so much an affair of the heart for her. It was almost more like, I guess, sexual harassment, or could even be considered coercive kind mm-hmm. of sexual relationship. But she is the mother then of Penelope. Mm-hmm. No, I'm getting this wrong. No, she's the mother of Julian, and Penelope's father is the father of Julian. So that's why Penelope's father, which also happens to be Julian's father, takes such an interest in Julian and sponsors him at the school and really tries to. He sees him as the son he always wanted and is thinking he'll take over the business and all of that. So when he develops a sexual relationship with his daughter, who is also Julian's half-sister, that, of course, is just so abhorrent, and that's why Penelope gets locked up.
Julian gets sent away. Yeah.
Julian is sent away, and they actually try to find him. But so then the author has decided not to have Julian discover this, that everybody keeps this from him. And, I guess in some ways, think it would have been better for him to know early on, or would have that have been so repulsive? I mean, who would want to know that, right?
I wonder what's worse, yeah, to know the truth and live with that, or to live with your kind of misimpressions, I guess. I don't know. I don't know what I would rather know either.
Until you know it, right? Well, and it's funny because I was thinking, obviously he managed. See, you phrased the question that Julian's life ends in tragedy while Daniel's ends in happiness. But I thought that Julian's ending sounded sort of hopeful at the end, because remember the pen that Daniel had was missing, and he thought he had woken up and given it to Julian and told him to keep writing. And so I think that in some ways, Julian, even with his, not knowing about Penelope, he didn't quite get over it, but he moved on, I think. That's what I like to think. It's not in the book, but
okay. So, but he's still—I mean, he's still a very tragic figure, because he's become deformed, I guess we could say, mm-hmm. because in his quest as Lane Colbert to find all the books that he had written and destroy them, because now that we, it's been revealed that they all have elements of Penelope and other people in his life in them, he just wants all of that, out of the world. And so in one of the warehouse fires, he's burned badly, but he survives. So he's extremely deformed. Nuria is his caretaker. I think he becomes mentally ill. You know, I think we could say that. He becomes obsessed with obtaining all of his books and destroying them. And we're not really sure what he's done in the pursuit of that. We know he's probably committed at least burglaries or robberies, but we don't know if he's killed people, too.
I think he did. Didn't he kill Nuria's boss?
Oh, yes. Because he was harassing her. So, mm-hmm. Yes, thank you. So he's become a very dark figure. And then Nuria is killed, and so he's lost his second chance at love. And so, I mean, I think there's just a lot of tragedy that follows him around, mm-hmm. and, of course, from his own choices. But yeah, I like what you think, though, that, you know, because the pen has disappeared, maybe he will put out new stories. Mm-hmm. You know, and he certainly has the material for them now, doesn't he?
Yes, absolutely.
So remind me, at the kind of the climactic scene at the Eldaya Mansion, when Fumero is there and his plan is to kill Julian finally, and Bea is there, and Daniel is there. I don't remember where I was going to go with that question, but... So we were talking about, the dark side of Julian. So I guess is that kind of a moment where he's given an opportunity for a second chance, maybe? Because he really has to intervene in some ways to save Daniel and Bea.
Mm-hmm. And I guess I was thinking Daniel, through Nuria's story, we learn that Daniel's sort of a new sense of hope for Julian. Julian watches Daniel and grows to appreciate him and hear, you know, how far along he is in his adventure. And so I guess I thought it was more he was willing to sacrifice his poor, tragic life to save Daniel's, who had a little more hope and a little more promise than he did.
I like that thought.
Yeah.
So we have a few more minutes left. If there are other people who want to call in, we're hoping we've fixed that glitch in our system, but our number is 745-8900. So I'd just like to talk about, I think, just a few more things about, because I think a strong message in this book is about how important books are. And there's another quote that Daniel says, "Once in my father's bookshop, I heard a regular customer say that few things leave a deeper mark on a reader than the first book that finds its way into his heart." So when we look at some of these quotes from this book, did you start to think about books that have been really important to you and you know, that you kind of carry with you throughout your life?
I have. Well, I think of them a lot because I love them so much. I think the first book I read that... Oh, my goodness, I couldn't stop reading it. It was The Alchemist by Paulo Coelho.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one for me where, it just hits you in the heart, and you can relate to it and make it apply to all different aspects of your life. And I still love it. I pick it up and still find new things. I have several favorite books, but that was really one of the first ones I read. And I can't believe I'm reading this. It's so beautiful and lovely. Mm-hmm. I loved it.
And as I've been talking to friends about a few books we've been reading, my other book club just read Mud Woman by Joyce Carol Oates. And there's some authors that you just really feel like the book is crafted.
Yeah.
This isn't just kind of a, you know, a regurgitating or, you know, I'm writing down this tale, but you can just tell the labor that went into it.
Mm-hmm.
Did you think of any books, Lauren? Or?
I did. I actually highlighted that because I loved that that line, leave a deeper mark on your heart. And I thought, actually, Catcher in the Rye was mine. That's why I highlighted originally thinking of that because, and then he also talks about, you know, being a young reader. And I thought from that age when I first read that book, I was in high school, but, and this is probably everyone's because it's a very important book to read at a young age. And I just thought it meant a lot to me, and it probably wouldn't mean as much to me in the future, but it's an incredibly important coming-of-age type of thing, and I think that, I don't think anything else, I guess. That's just my book.
And probably when I was at your age, I would have said the same thing,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, because I think you pinned that down pretty accurately, that when I reread the book, all I could think of was, what? It just didn't read the same as mm-hmm. when I, you know.
But in this book, you get the impression that you put some of yourself into a book, and who says it? Books are like mirrors, so you get something out of the book that you're reading, and it reflects who you are and who you see yourself as at the time that you're reading it.
Exactly. So at different points in our life, we're going to have different kinds mm-hmm. of reflections about a book.
Which is why it was even cooler that he, you know, this was his book from childhood till, it goes pretty far into the future at the end there, and it seems like this book is still affecting his life, which is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. And I guess if there's, you know, people, and we all know people who don't read, and I think that that's kind of sad that, you know, when they do the surveys and there's actually people who either do not read at all or people who read very little, and this can include college graduates, and so it just seems sad to me that they're missing out on this whole wonderful world of, you know, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, but certainly with fiction, to visit other places and meet characters like, you know, in the mm-hmm. Shadow of the Wind.
And it's cheaper than going to a movie, so, and it lasts longer. So, you know, you get some entertainment for your buck.
Exactly. And as a librarian, I'm sure you get challenges like that all the time, trying to, you know, people say, oh, I wish I have this friend and I wish they would read more. What would you recommend?
And it's tough because it's usually a loved one coming in at a desperate point saying, I've got a reluctant reader, whether it's someone they're married to or a kid or whoever, like, what can I get? And you never know what the hook's going to be for anyone, but that is kind of a problem we like to try and help solve, because there are so many stories, and like the book said, just universes to get lost into. And so if we can find one good book for someone, we feel like we've done well.
Just another quote from early on when Daniel's in the Cemetery of Forgotten Books and Isaac is the caretaker, and he says, "This is a place of mystery, Daniel, a sanctuary. Every book, every volume you see here has a soul, the soul of the person who wrote it and of those who read it and lived and dreamed with it."
Mm-hmm. How beautiful is that?
Yes, that's just a lovely, lovely sentiment. So I want to thank Katie and Lauren and Melissa for calling. And anyone else who was out there that joined us that perhaps just was listening quietly, we were talking about The Shadow of the Wind on Radio Book Club for October's Friends of Library Week. And next month we'll be discussing Carried in Our Hearts by Jane Aronson. November is Adoption Awareness Month, and I'll be talking about that topic with Betsy Wooden from Alaska Center for Resource Families and Tammy Watson from Catholic Social Services Special Needs Adoption Office. And I also want to remind listeners that Radio Free Palmer is a community station that relies on support from listeners like you. So please take the time to visit our website, radiofreepalmer.org, and become a contributing member. This is Judy Getty with Radio Book Club. Happy reading.